Cheers.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn, Anna Mateo, and John Russell. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
India's continued struggles with the coronavirus pandemic are threatening the country's goals to reduce severe air pollution. Restrictions related to the pandemic have made it difficult to carry out emergency measures aimed at reducing critical pollution levels. In the past, India's government has ordered the closure of schools and buildings in populated centers to reduce levels of harmful air. It has also attempted to get more people to use public transportation to reduce vehicle emissions and to ride buses that run on cleaner fuels. But social distancing rules and economic concerns have affected the progress of such actions. For example, the pandemic has led to limits on the number of passengers permitted on public buses. Surinder Singh is a bus driver in New Delhi. He told the Associated Press he feels trapped between the country's two public health emergencies, pollution and the pandemic. Singh sits for hours in heavy traffic, breathing in the city's polluted air. In addition, he says he worries about catching the coronavirus every time a person gets on his bus. The 47-year-old father of two says the current economic situation gives him no choice but to go to work. He carries hand sanitizer and wears a face covering to reduce his chances of becoming infected. But, Singh says, I drive the bus in constant fear. Millions of others across India face a similar situation as the country experiences a historic recession. The economy shrank by 23.9% in the April to June quarter, its worst performance in at least 24 years. The virus continues to spread in India, with over 9.7 million cases and more than 140,000 deaths. In addition to people with COVID-19, the disease caused by the coronavirus, Indian hospitals are also filling up with patients suffering with conditions related to air pollution. Some of the country's long-term pollution targets have now been delayed by economic recovery plans. India plans to increase coal production to reduce imports. And the recovery plans depend heavily on energy sources that produce carbon emissions. This pandemic will define the pathway of how we move in the future to control air pollution, said Sunil Daya. He is an expert with the Center for Research on Energy and Clean Air. The threats posed by both the virus and pollution have hit New Delhi extremely hard. This year, the yearly rise in winter pollution has come at the same time as a sharp increase in new virus cases. The city is among the most polluted in India, where an estimated 1.67 million people die each year from bad air. Dr. Akshay Budraja is a respiratory doctor at a private hospital in New Delhi. He told the AP the hospital has been flooded with patients with respiratory issues who thought they had COVID-19. Patients are very, very anxious, he said. Pollution in New Delhi gets worse in the fall and winter when crop burning in neighboring states combines with cooler temperatures that trap smoke close to the city. Over 76,000 farm fires were spotted by satellites in Punjab state, the most since 2016. And the city's air quality levels in October were worse than past years. The pandemic also has delayed efforts to clean emissions at coal-fired power plants, which make up about 65% of India's electricity. The government had asked plants to add technology that would remove sulfur dioxide from their emissions by 2022. But financing issues related to the pandemic made it impossible to import the required equipment, industry officials said. I'm Brian Lynn.
A new study has found that trained dogs can identify people with COVID-19, even when those people show no signs of the illness. In the study, researchers collected a small amount of sweat from the underarm area of 177 test subjects. Some were infected with COVID-19. And some had tested negative for the coronavirus. The dogs then smelled the sweat samples and tried to identify infected people from non-infected people. Early results from the study were published December 10th in PLOS One. The results were based on data gathered in March of this year. The researchers have since confirmed these early findings in additional tests. That is what study leader Dominique Grandjean told the Reuters news agency. He is with the Alfort Veterinary School in France. The dogs, researchers said, were able to correctly identify infected individuals 76 to 100% of the time. Also, the dogs were able to rule out infection 92 to 99% of the time. And, Grandjean adds, they were able to do these things quickly. It takes 1/10 of a second, he said, for a trained dog to say yes or no. Training the dogs requires 3 to 8 weeks. The length of time depends on whether the dog is already trained for smell detection. The study involved 6 detection dogs, 3 explosive detection dogs, 1 search and rescue dog, and 2 colon cancer detection dogs. The research was carried out in 2 places, Paris, France, and Beirut, Lebanon. It involved 177 people. Of those 177, 95 tested positive for COVID-19 and had signs of sickness. The other 82 test subjects were COVID-19 negative and had no signs of sickness. COVID-19 detecting dogs, Grandjean explained, have already been used in airports in the United Arab Emirates. The UAE government plans to help other countries use trained dogs as well. On December 16th, the UAE and the International K9 Working Group Against COVID-19 held an online event explaining the use of these trained dogs. Representatives from 25 countries attended the workshop. I'm Ana Mateo.
Imagine you want to talk about the time something happened. Perhaps you want to describe the time you did something important, the night something happened, or the day something took place. In today's Everyday Grammar, we will explore one useful way to describe time, adjective clauses. Let's begin with a few important terms and ideas. Clauses are groups of words that have a subject and a predicate. Clauses can stand alone as sentences, or they can play a part in a larger sentence. Consider this statement.
I love English grammar.
The subject is I, and the predicate is love English grammar. Adjective clauses, also called relative clauses, act like adjectives in a sentence. In other words, these clauses modify or give further information about a noun. Consider this example.
This is the song that I heard last night.
The adjective clause is that I heard last night. It gives more information about the noun song. Adjective clauses have many uses. They can help describe places, reasons, times, and more. In some cases, words such as that, who, where, or when begin adjective clauses. But in other cases, English speakers leave out these words. Let's examine how English speakers use adjective clauses to describe times. There are two common ways that you should know about: noun of time plus nothing, and noun of time plus when. We will look at both of these in greater detail. Our first structure is noun of time plus nothing. In other words, no special term begins the adjective clause. Consider these words by the Monkees.
On the day we fall in love, you and me. On the day we fall in love, you'll see.
In the example, the noun of time is the word day. The adjective clause is we fall in love. We is the subject of the clause, and fall in love is the predicate. Note that there were no special words such as that or when at the beginning of the adjective clause. Let's consider another example. Imagine an American family is running late to a holiday dinner. When they arrive, they find that all of the sweets have already been eaten. They might say,
they had eaten all of the desserts by the time we arrived. Can you believe that?
In our example, the noun of time is the word time. The adjective clause is the words we arrived. Our second structure is noun of time plus when. The word when, a relative adverb, begins the adjective clause. Consider these words from John Anderson.
There was a time when was alone. I was all right by myself.
In the example, the noun of time is the word time. The word when begins the adjective clause. I is the subject of that clause, and was alone is the predicate. There are not really strict rules about when to use special words to begin adjective clauses. Try listening to Americans speak in films or news reports, and keep note of how these speakers use adjective clauses to describe times. Then try to use those structures when you practice speaking. Let's finish our report with a quiz. Listen to these lines from Chris and Morgan Stapleton.
From the moment you wake me up till you kiss me goodnight, everything that you do, it makes me want more of you.
Can you tell where the noun of time is? Can you tell where the adjective clause is? Write us in the comments section of our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. I'm John Russell.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Grover Cleveland was elected President of the United States in 1884. He was the first Democratic Party candidate to win a presidential election in almost 28 years. Grover Cleveland defeated James Blaine, a senator from the Republican Party. The election was very close. Many Republicans did not vote for their own candidate. They voted for Cleveland instead. They believed he was honest and that Blaine was not. Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe tell us about the presidency of Grover Cleveland.
Cleveland began his administration by announcing that he would reduce waste in the government. He would make government more like business. He said he would support reforms to let ability, not politics, decide who would get government jobs. Democratic Party leaders were quick to protest. They explained to Cleveland that the party owed jobs to those who had worked for his victory. Cleveland had to compromise. He permitted about 80,000 government jobs to be taken from Republicans and given to Democrats. This left 12,000 jobs. These would be given to people who did the best on government examinations. Cleveland's decision angered Republican reformers who had voted for him. They accused him of surrendering to the leaders of the Democratic Party.
On other issues, however, Cleveland refused to compromise. He opposed government economic aid to any industrial group. He vetoed a bill giving aid to farmers whose crops had failed. And he vetoed another bill giving more money to men who had served as soldiers during America's Civil War of the 1860s. The president also showed his independence by investigating gifts of public land that the government had made to the railroad, wood, and cattle industries. He found that many of these land grants were made illegally. He got back much of the land. He opened it to settlers.
President Cleveland signed into law two bills he believed would improve government. One was the Electoral Count Act. It set new rules for counting the electoral votes of the states. It would prevent future disputes over presidential elections, like the one in 1876. The other bill changed the list of officials who could become president if the president and vice president died or were removed from office. First on the list, after the vice president, was the Secretary of State. Congress changed this law again in 1947, and there have been four amendments since then. Today, the Speaker of the House of Representatives would succeed the vice president as president. Then would come the president pro tempore of the Senate, and then the Secretary of State.
Grover Cleveland approved a bill giving the government control over the cost of railroad transportation. The bill was called the Interstate Commerce Act. It limited the amount of money railroads could demand from people who needed to travel or transport their goods. The law established the idea that the government could control industries when necessary for the public good. President Cleveland also was concerned about a growing number of labor disputes that took place in the United States in the late 1800s. He proposed that Congress create a labor committee to help settle the disputes.
Congress failed to act on this proposal, but its lack of action did not stop the rise of a labor organization that had been formed a few years earlier. The group soon would become the most important labor union in the United States. It was the American Federation of Labor, or AFL. Led by Samuel Gompers, the AFL was different from earlier labor groups. It did not try to put all workers into one union. Instead, it tied together a number of different unions and gave them general leadership.
The AFL was different in other ways. It did not oppose the economic system of capitalism. It said only that labor should get more of the earnings of capitalism. The AFL also opposed extremists who used labor protests to change the social system. What the AFL called for were things workers wanted immediately: higher wages, a shorter work day, better working conditions. One of its first demands was an 8-hour work day. This demand led to a number of strikes and protests throughout the country.
The most serious incident took place in Chicago's Haymarket Square. More than 1,000 union supporters went to a meeting there, organized by an extremist. They stood calmly and listened to speeches. Just before the meeting ended, someone threw a bomb into a group of policemen. The bomb exploded with a blinding flash. 7 policemen were killed. The other policemen began shooting at the crowd. Some people in the crowd fired back. When it was all over, 10 persons had been shot to death. 50 others were hurt. The incident set off a wave of fear and anger across the country. The public demanded action against Union extremists. The Haymarket Square violence slowed the growth of organized labor in the United States for many years. It would be some time before labor became a powerful force in national events.
In the spring of 1886, President Cleveland announced that he was to be married. The ceremony took place in the White House. A few months later, President Cleveland and the First Lady went to New York City for the official ceremony welcoming the Statue of Liberty. The statue was a gift to the people of the United States from the people of France. It represented the alliance between their two countries during America's war for independence from Britain. The statue was the creation of French artist Frédéric Auguste Bartholdi. He decided to make a statue that would represent freedom, a statue of liberty. He said it should stand on an island in New York Harbor. There, he said, it would welcome all who came to America through that gateway.
Bartholdi decided to make a copper statue in the image of a woman, Lady Liberty. High above her head, she would hold a torch of freedom to light the world. The statue's face was the face of Bartholdi's mother. The artist asked French engineer Gustave Eiffel to build a steel support to hold the heavy statue. Eiffel was the man who later built the Eiffel Tower in Paris. The statue was built in France. Then the pieces were sent across the Atlantic Ocean. It was rebuilt in New York.
Grover Cleveland and his wife were not the only Americans to attend the Statue of Liberty ceremonies in 1886. Thousands of people crowded onto ships in the harbor to watch the great event. Thousands of others crowded the shorelines around the harbor. Everyone cheered wildly when a signal was given and a huge cloth fell from the statue. Lady Liberty stood holding her torch high for freedom. Under her feet were the broken chains of tyranny. Below the statue was a poem. It called to the poor and oppressed people of the world. It told them to come to America to find a land of hope and freedom.
Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shores. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed, to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door.
The Statue of Liberty was a great success. It was one of the great engineering wonders of its time, and it filled Americans with pride in their tradition of freedom and openness to people from all lands.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.